wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM in Portland. We have a very full program, so let's get right to it. On today's Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks with Emery Mort, Portland activist and our street historian. They discuss the victory Portland protesters won in driving Trump's federal troops off Portland streets and into their barracks. Bill then takes off with a commentary on the future of our great insurgent movement that rose 2 months ago under the banner of Black Lives Matter. Patricia Kohlberg speaks with University of Washington medical student Naomi Nkinsey about how racist ideas about African American bodies are embedded in medical science, and how students, doctors, and scholars are challenging so-called race-based medicine, which was supposed to improve care for African Americans. For our regular monthly episode, Another World is Possible, I'll revisit a dystopian novel published 35 years ago and set in our year, 2020. Would we have acted any differently if we'd taken the author's warnings seriously? The novel is Goodman 2020 by Fred Feile, an Oregonian for some of the time he was writing it. This will be part one of a two-part series on Feile's dystopian vision. You'll hear extracts from the novel read by Patricia Kohlberg. Now to begin, here is Bill Resnick with Emery Mort.
Hi, Emery Mort. What happened Thursday night, July 30th? What happened at across from the federal courthouse in the sort of the government center of Portland?
I got down there about 10 o'clock, and there's a lot that goes on at these events, different groups and different actions and different activities and different focuses. But before things ever really got to in front of the federal courthouse, there's lots of speeches in front of the Justice Center the next block over, and there was a march of the moms who are now under a different name. I think it's called like Moms United for Black Lives or something. And then the speeches up at the Justice Center I thought were really good. People were really together. There were a lot of people down there. And then they kind of moved over in front of the federal courthouse. Then I don't know their names, but there were some fantastic women leaders, black people of color leaders who got on the megaphone and, I don't know, really kind of held the crowd for like a long time with a lot of passion. And yeah, there were people just kind of, as every night, there's people all over. There's people just out on the periphery talking. There's people nearby chanting. But yeah, the night went on and basically, no officers ever came out of the building, which was the key. But other than that, the night was the same as most of the other nights recently. It was the same kind of energy. You know, every night's a little different, but the brutal attacks that the feds have been doing these last few nights, and even the PPB this past weekend, you know, they had nothing to do with people misbehaving. They were just sadistic and desires to gain information, intimidate a crowd, hurt and gas people. But the idea that last night was like more peaceful than other nights had nothing to do with the crowd. The crowd has been peaceful most of these nights. I think if the state troopers had been out there inside the fence, you know, I personally would have wanted to engage with them a lot more, like just verbally, because I'm angry at things, and I'm sure other people are too. But
I saw a picture of a demonstrator and a state trooper looking at each other. I wasn't sure, but the state troopers never came out, right? That picture was...
The troopers had come out earlier in the day. I'm not sure when. They might have been out there multiple times. That had happened already. They had some troopers out there in their little hats or whatever, and they were talking with some people. But yeah, if you look at the statements from the state officials, their goal, they really, really want to calm this thing down. I think their goal is to not have those troopers out there at all. That fence is reinforced on double sides.
Not having RoboCops, it seems to me, is also important. I mean, these men in there, they look like machines, right, with those bizarre outfits. It's insulting, and it also is a demonstration sort of state brutal power, right? It's enormously provocative.
Yeah, I mean, look, the last night, they knew they were pulling out. They got out this huge new device that's just blowing ridiculous amounts of tear gas just right into people's faces, right into women's faces, moms' faces. They blow them off the fence, and then they march out a block from their building, and they attack them in the street with all sorts of munitions. That's what they did two nights ago. That was just one of five different stare downs and battles they got in with people, but it was mostly on women. And if you think about these manly police who say they're out protecting us, you know, how many of them were out there defending these women from getting attacked? You know, it just lays it all bare. These people don't care about anything. They don't care about the people here. The police see these people as the enemy. The federal police see these people as the enemy. And it's just blatantly obvious. And it's all ridiculous, and it should all be dismantled. It's been so absurd. You know, I'm just, like, taking my first, you know, I've only been tear gassed once of the past three nights after having it 7 days in a row. So I'm starting to kind of, like, take a deep breath and take in what I just experienced. But, I find what we just went through is an outrage. You know, they committed environmental destruction. They committed so much violence against women. They committed so much violence against older people. Just standing there, gassing them. They committed so much violence that they had to pull out with their tails between their legs because they were hurting the image of the U.S. military so badly. The Department of Homeland Security, they were just like damaging themselves so badly while they were online bragging about it. In reality, they knew. They knew that we were defeating them by just standing there and taking it and coming back and standing face to face with them. You know, Wednesday night, people over and over chose to form walls and stand face to face with these armed people who you have no idea what they're going to do. They were doing different maneuvers. They were showing up on top of multiple buildings, looking down on you with guns. They were pulling maneuvers where they brought a line in behind you and pinched people in to a block, thinking they might all get mass arrested or who knows what. They were just out all kinds of different ways. It was like standoffs for hours on end, and they never let you rest. They go back in, they come back out, they attack some more. They do a ridiculously insane amount of gas at like 1:30 in the morning. I mean, it's just sadism, but, you know, the mainstream press, you're not allowed to say that the U.S. military and all these people, that they're sadists, that they're fascists. So we end up saying like, oh, well, they must have been provoked by some, you know, no, they're just doing sadistic pain on women and people they view as like anti-government. I don't even know. Like they just feel entitled to do that to people. And the Portland Police Bureau, they were working with the feds the whole time. They were super sadistic out there on like a Saturday night. They were pushing people around downtown. So, you know, it'll be an interesting time to see what happens now, because a bunch of taboos were just blown open publicly. And it's probably, this will be the end.
There's a lot of lawsuits, and there's also a lot of arrestees that they're going to either have to release or they're going to go to trial. I think they're in for investigations as well as what happened.
Yeah, they arrested people.
And
they're gathering
people
tons of intelligence. They're gathering intelligence on us. So they're arresting, you know, a lot of the people they're arresting did no violence whatsoever. They're like the most calm, responsible people out there. They're arresting some of them and like stealing their equipment. And those people have contacts all throughout the community. So they're building intelligence files on, they're criminalizing those young people among us, you know, millennials, younger, who are out there like doing the right thing, trying to be responsible, photograph what they're doing, keep track of relationships out there on the street. Those are the people they're targeting for arrest. And they'll take them in, they'll try to take a DNA sample, they ask for a social security number, all these things that they're not supposed to do. They just put you in a cell. And then they just release you, sometimes with no charges, but then they'll take your phone and they'll get into people's phones and get all their contacts. So they're running these intelligence operations that are attempts at intimidation, coercion, blackmail, criminalization, etc. So all that stuff's going on too. They were even opening intelligence files. You know, the Washington Post caught the Homeland Security opening intelligence files on New York Times journalists who were here. Mike Baker, New York Times journalist. So that's how bold they feel. You know, that's like extremely illegal to do that. opening an actual file that they're passing between intelligence agencies to get into this journalist's contacts. If they're doing it to someone like that who has tons of legal cover, they're doing it to all of us who have no legal cover. And so, you know, other people in other cities will see that and fear that. That's part of it, too.
Yeah, what you're expressing is constitutional violations. My guess is there's a lot of lawyers affiliated with the ACLU and other groups and to the left of the ACLU who would be very happy to begin inquiring about what they were doing with people's telephones and where those files are going and who they're being shared with.
Yeah, but you can't get it. You can't get it because they classify it. I'm just saying, like, it's why getting that information has to come out via these leaks that come out, these big document dumps and leaks and stuff like that. They don't give it up because, you know, they're labeling people here, this is terrorist activity. So once it's terrorist activity, that's like federal classified. That's like a war type of thing. So the ACLU can't go in there and get that kind of stuff. That's why people are leaking this stuff to the press. So we'll see. There's going to be a million problems for society, and it's just one of them. But yeah.
This is Bill Resnick talking to Emory Moore, Portland street historian. He's been to over 50 protests in the last 2 months, written on them on Facebook, and been interviewed on KABU. We're discussing the protests, summing things up, how the federal troops were driven out of the city, and the Portland police put on the defensive, hopefully to be forced to very, very significantly change. Well, it seemed to me, though, was quite outstanding was, I guess there was a party afterwards, right? Was there dancing and singing and chanting? And
almost every night there's dancing and singing. It's just last night there just happened to be no police attacks. But, yeah, it was a great night for Portland. People were out. It was beautiful to see the sort of some of the moms come together, and just the spirit of people out there, you know, overall is absolutely tremendous. It's an absolute like quantum leap forward for, you know, white people willing to stand strong for Black Lives Matter. So yeah, it was beautiful out there, but I would just caution to say, you know, it wasn't more beautiful than the night before or the night before or the night before. Every night has been amazing spirit out there, amazing speeches, amazing actions, amazing organizing, amazing service, people playing drums and music while we're getting attacked, let alone while we're just hanging out. You know, people like keeping the spirit up and really working for it. And that's how we were able to get through this so successfully. And then, yeah, it then comes down to how people handle interpreting and talking about the events afterwards. And that includes journalists, and it also includes prominent people. So if like a fire gets set sometime, then someone can say it was a violent protest. And then a bunch of people can come out and say that all the people there were violent protesters and that they're all bad and that they all deserved to be gassed. So A, people shouldn't believe that. B, people shouldn't be out there doing that and saying those kinds of things. C, people should go to the events and they should carefully record what happened and push back against this kind of thing. And then you mentioned there also the police have cameras, and these federal police have all sorts of really intense technological equipment that has been reported on now. They got their planes, they got Stingray devices, you know, all sorts of stuff. So they are, you know, if you just go to the mom's march, that's what they want. You can just walk around, society's not going to change, whatever. It's still a really cool event. But at these events where something might change, that's when the counter-revolutionary measures come out. So, oh, you want to come to this event? Well, the police have a method called raising the price of participation. Oh, you want to come to it? Well, you might get attacked, or we might have your video now, or you start to get closer and closer to being criminalized. That's how these things work. That's how U.S. liberal hegemony worldwide works.
Hi, folks. That was me, Bill Resnick, talking to Emory Moore, Portland activist and our street historian, who's been to over 50 Black Lives Matter protests over the last 2 months, all those marches, car caravans, picnics, protests, mostly masked with attempt at social distancing. All over Portland, they prepared for the culmination of this chapter of Portland's struggle. Emory Moore described it The culmination came Thursday and Friday, July 30th and 31st, the last of the huge nightly protests in the confrontation zone in front of the courthouses and the two parks. Emory described the contrast between the near entirely nonviolent but determined, spirited, militant, mutually aiding protesters and the callous and vicious behavior of the federal troops and the Portland police. What was their aim, as described by Emory? Well, to raise the price of participation, to dominate the streets as ordered by Trump, that wannabe deranged autocrat trying to intimidate a people who would not yield. That was where my recorded talk with Emory ended. So right now, I'll continue with a mole commentary on what lies ahead. To begin, when the troops withdrew to the inside of the federal courthouse, that was a great victory. But still, it was just one successful battle, and over the next months, we are sure to be further tested. All the way through the long COVID-19 pandemic, the coming election, and into the next years of continuous struggle, the challenge we face is to continue, indeed, strengthen the spirit and powerful movements, not just in Portland, but across the country, and to build those movements here and everywhere. But more specifically, what does that mean? What to do now in Portland? Well, let's start with transforming police. In fact, the whole criminal justice system. 70, 60 years ago, black struggle, known as the Civil Rights Movement, of course, it ignited a great uprising that won a great deal for many, including women, sexual minorities, the not fully abled, more, but not very much for blacks and other people of color. We must ensure that today's struggle has better results for Afro-Americans. In Portland, that means, first, large steps to defund the police, to force the city council to create democratically organized, often peer-to-peer helping services, to replace police handling of homelessness and mental health emergency addiction for those who want help, school disorder, troubled children, domestic violence in most cases, help for people in sex work who want to leave. Those are not jobs for police. And second, we have to end police impunity and killing. How? Take the lead from the groups and the police reform network to challenge in police contract negotiation. Pushing the city to take action that they have refused to do for years, especially as to the use of force. Also to push Portland's new district attorney, who ran on a reform platform, push him to take real action on many fronts to keep the police accountable. Also, of course, strengthen the Police Citizen Review Board, making sure the voters come out in the coming election to change the city charter. We also must work to end poverty and precarity and homelessness. In this city, like across the country, inequality is fast growing, so is evictions, homelessness, inability for even those with health insurance to afford the co-pays, and then there's student debt, all growing. Portland at minimum can do a lot as to poverty, homelessness, and evictions, and commit itself to a militant push for state and federal action. Then, of course, we have to stop climate change. It's been on the City Council agenda over the last 20 years, and they've taken some action. For one, it's created a very comprehensive, very beautifully illustrated, award-winning climate action plan, and updated it every 5 years. Not only that, they recently declared a climate change emergency, an official pronouncement. But, very unfortunately, they have done almost nothing to implement their plan or to deal with the emergency, which requires dramatic reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. When compared to several larger and smaller cities in California, Portland has done virtually nothing. Well, what must Portland do? Well, emulate those many other cities around the world, including in California, to build out an electrified transport, to build cultures of energy conservation and use reduction, and to build out local clean and green renewable sun and wind energy production with local storage. Instead of big top-down corporate bureaucracies, those local agencies of energy production and distribution, they can be advised and accountable to local people. Its workers can rotate jobs, learn skills, take part in agency decision-making. And confederated locally and regionally, these public agencies are much more reliable, much less expensive, much quicker and easier to build out than the humongous corporate systems. They require vastly expensive, environmentally destructive, continent-spanning grids that, like so many grand plans of the military-industrial complex, they'll never be completed. In these local struggle and battles, we can educate ourselves and share with our comrades and show to others that all this and more is possible, that we, humanity, possess all the technologies in every area of material and cultural production, in energy and agriculture, communications, transportation, environmental restoration. We can build a truly democratic, sustainable, caring, and flourishing societies. In fact, we have built examples around the planet that succeed, that only must be universalized, of course, adapted for local circumstances. We also know how to organize democratically. A huge literature has examined cooperative, democratically operating teams and operations in near every area of human nature, not just material production in workshops, but also in schools, houses, groups, worship groups, rehabilitation programs, even sports teams, some self-managed by players. We know that nearly all of us, ordinary folks of an extraordinary species, have the capacity for love and caring, for democratically working together and making democratic decisions that are optimal and just. So in our current system, these capacities are manipulated, stunted, deformed. In our highly stratified society, where a small, rich minority dominate decision-making the way things work, but still these capacities do get expressed in social groups, in schools, churches, unions, and movements. We know the peoples around the world are hungry for change, and they know change is necessary, and they can be mobilized around the change program. Yes, it's a big agenda, huge program, but when you break it down into sectors like the police and criminal justice, climate change, healthcare, social decision-making, work organization, we know what succeeds. Still, the recent uprising galvanized the nation and showed things could change, and business as usual cannot continue, if only because our current system is destroying the ecosystems upon which life depends. We have no choice but to mobilize for sweeping change, for reconstruction of all production and the ways of life of the industrialized countries, which democratic revolution, of course, our formidable enemies fear. Still, we have shown what can and must be done. That ends my sermonette. I hope everybody stays active, marching, singing, reading, teaching ourselves, arguing, and pushing the city to start modeling the reconstruction we need. This was Bill Resnick for the Old Mole in these interesting times, brimming over with danger and opportunity.
Thank you, Bill and Emery. Patricia Kohlberg and Jan Hocken recently had a conversation on the Old Mole about racial premises built into our healthcare system. Patricia, former medical director for Multnomah County, follows that conversation by talking today with Naomi Nkinsey. Patricia?
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and I'm going to be speaking today with a special guest, Naomi Nkinsey from University of Washington, about how racism gets embedded into medical science. Naomi Nkinsey is a medical student, as I said, at University of Washington Medical School, and she is also studying for a master's degree in public health. And in the past year, she led a successful effort at University of Washington to get the medical center to abandon a so-called race correction for a commonly used test. So welcome to KABU, Naomi Nkinsey.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be speaking with you today.
We would like to think that medical sciences is objective and fact-based. It's science after all. Supposedly it's based on rational thought and experimentation, but it turns out this isn't always the case. So I'd like to start, Naomi, by having you tell us about this particular test of kidney function and what is so problematic about it.
This particular test is used to measure something that we called EGFR. So that's estimated glomerular filtration rate. And basically what this is that it measures the rate at which your kidneys filter products. And in that urine, you also get a byproduct of muscle breakdown called creatinine. So what this test does is it measures the filtration of the kidneys, and it gives us an estimate of how functional someone's kidneys are. So in order to measure this, we use an equation called the MDRD equation. And in this equation, along with sex, Another factor that's taken into consideration is a person's race, but more specifically, if a person is Black versus non-Black. So what this coefficient does is that if the patient is Black, it has a multiplying factor of 1.21. So what this means clinically is that if you are a Black patient, you could be at the same level of creatinine expulsion as a non-Black person, but because the GFR is being calculated with a multiplying factor because of your skin color, your kidney functioning will actually look artificially better than it would if you were non-Black. This means that if you are a Black individual, it takes a higher level of kidney disease to be marked as having kidney dysfunction. So this plays a large role in clinical practice because GFR is measured in order to determine who can get a kidney transplant. So we prioritize kidney transplantation for people that have lower kidney function. If you are a Black individual, it actually takes longer for you to get at the point of GFR functioning where you can qualify for a kidney transplant. So this leads to Black people waiting on kidney transplant lists for a longer period of time, getting treatment with later, more end-stage kidney disease, and then lesser and poorer health outcomes compared to non-Black individuals.
So, Naomi, was there any science behind this race correction?
Yeah, so the reason this came about was because of a study in 1999 called the MDRD study. So this was a study of 1,628 participants, and the purpose of this study was to find a better way to measure kidney functioning in a way that was, you know, less invasive and more accurate than what we had at the time. So this study found that when they were measuring people's creatinine, which again is a measure of muscle breakdown, that Black individuals had higher levels of creatinine in their urine. So from this, they made the jump that if you were Black, it meant that you had greater muscle mass, so that your creatinine level wasn't actually predictive of your kidney functioning, but it was because you were Black and had therefore more muscle. And it's important to note that in this study, the justification of Black people having more muscle mass isn't founded on any type of accurate science. So they cited three studies that look to identify difference in body composition between Black and white individuals. And these studies were problematic in that there was issues with consent, and also that the researchers, they were the ones that determined who was Black or non-Black. So by looking at a person, they said, this person's Black, this person looks white. And the definitions of race between the studies actually changed. It's flawed, and the fact that this is being used as a justification is also problematic.
So let's turn for a little bit on how you organized against this deeply flawed race correction.
I became involved in this my first year of medical school, and we had a lecture in which we were taught the MDRD equation. And we were just taught that race plays a role in kidney functioning, in particular Black race. And there was no further explanation given to our class. In the Seattle cohort of UW students, I'm one of five Black people. So you can imagine that I was sitting in class, you know, surrounded by people that in general don't look like me, being taught by a white professor, and having to sit there and listen to him saying that my body is inherently inferior or physiologically different because of the amount of melanin in my skin. So in that lecture, I asked, you know, what is the physiologic pathway that links melanin to kidney function? How do you identify a patient as Black? What happens if a patient is mixed race or doesn't look Black to the physician but has Black ancestry? And the only information that could be given about why we were using race in this equation was because Black people have more muscle mass. And of course, You know, I'm someone that grew up running track and field and cross country in middle and high school. And that's always an argument that you heard as a stereotype. Well, oh, you're running fast because Black people have more muscle. Mm. So the fact that this was being touted as science and being taught to medical students to then perpetuate that with their own patients was so mind-boggling to me, because in every other aspect of our education, we've been asked to focus on precision and evidence-based. And something like this with so little evidence was still being used today and having impact on patients. So from there, I met with the lead of our CPR units, one of my professors, and I had a really great conversation with him for a few hours, actually. I talked to him about why I felt this was problematic, the research that I had found that showed that having race included in GFR led to poorer outcomes for Black patients. And then working in partnership with the Anti-Racism Action Committee at our school, it was a perfect foundation where you already have an established organization that takes students' concerns and brings in faculty members to be able to have those conversations. So this is where allies like Liz Stein and others who aren't Black students but had heard my complaints came forward, and they took on the burden of meeting with faculty to explain this issue with them. So it started as, you know, a student movement, and then we had buy-in from faculty that were allies, and then they kind of took it upon themselves to kind of, you know, round up their own faculty members and discuss with them why this was problematic. And then from there, laboratory medicine and nephrology and internal medicine and family medicine got together. And they did an investigation of the UW Medicine patient population to determine whether or not this would be a feasible change. And they actually found that there was no physiological difference in kidney function between Black patients and other patients.
So this is Patricia Kullberg, and I'm speaking today with medical student Naomi Nkinsey about how race gets embedded in clinical science. Could you tell us a little bit about a very interesting study that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine just this past June about race-based algorithms?
Yeah, so this study came out that pointed out all of the different ways that race is built into algorithms that are used to make clinical decisions. For example, for pulmonary function tests, for the kidney test that we talked about, for determine if someone in labor needs a C-section or a vaginal delivery. This was a study that really laid it out plain and simple that race is built into these algorithms and in all cases is inappropriate because, again, race isn't biological.
And as I recall from reading the article, nearly all the consequences were unfavorable to African Americans in a clinical setting. Is this not true?
Yes, this is true. Again, these algorithms reinforce the idea that Black bodies are physiologically different than others and that they're inherently inferior. So putting those into the algorithms really kind of sets it in stone that a patient that comes in and is Black will be getting different care from non-Black patients.
There are observed differences between the races in clinical medicine. For example, Black people have more hypertension and they appear to have greater salt sensitivity than people who are not Black. And this has led to the practice of so-called race-based medicine, which I think the original impulse was that this would potentially bring benefits to people of color. But tell us a little bit about this and the problems with it.
So the issue with race-based medicine at its core is that it implies that race is biological when it's not. So race is a social construct. And what we are trying to move towards is rather than saying race is a risk factor for certain diseases like hypertension, that racism is that risk factor and the impacts of racism. Race-based medicine, like you said, people thought that it would lead to better outcomes for people of color, particularly Black people, but that hasn't been the case. And part of it is because race doesn't really exist, right? It's fluid. the definition of race has changed over time. And really what we should be moving towards is looking at genetics. Because when we say race, usually we're using it as a proxy for ancestry and genetic ancestry. So moving away from race-based medicine is a way to be more precise in the language that we're using and more precise in the care that we're giving.
This is interesting. When I was in practice, it seemed to me that clinicians and researchers always wanted to explain things in terms of bad luck, bad behavior, or bad genes, and that bad environment and bad social conditions were much less likely to be part of the explanatory model. And while I think you might agree with that assessment, you're also saying that there is some value in understanding ancestry, which is not the same as race.
Yes. So one example that I can give for this is with sickle cell disease. So sickle cell disease is a disease that misshapes your red blood cells, which carry oxygen throughout your body, and can lead to severe pain and a host of other issues. Sickle cell disease is traditionally taught as a disease that impacts Black people. The reasoning that they give is because, you know, Black people have ancestry in Africa, and in parts of Africa, malaria is endemic. So using Black race, again, is being used as a proxy for something else, because really sickle cell is common in all populations that have ancestry in areas where malaria is endemic. So parts of South America, parts of the Mediterranean, parts of Europe, so not just Africa. So again, this is another example where race and ancestry and genetics are being kind of all blended together when really they're separate things.
It sounds to me like you have many, many issues that you could tackle as an activist. And as you work on these issues, how have you experienced that work? How has that gone for you?
It's interesting because I tend to get support from other students, particularly other students of color. But when it comes to support from faculty or the administration of the school, that only tends to come after media outlets pick things up and congratulate the school. But during the process of speaking out, there is a lot of pushback. So one specific example I can give is that our school is regional, so we do rotations in all parts of the Pacific Northwest. And a lot of those areas are very rural, predominantly white areas. So in a question and answer panel, I spoke up to ask about how students of color, especially Black students or students that, for example, wear hijabs where they're going to be more visible than others, how do we protect those students when going into more rural areas that might not be as open to them? The response I got back from one of the deans was an email saying that my question asking about racism from these communities was offensive, and that the video recording would be edited to remove my question from it before it was disseminated out to students.
You were erased.
Yeah, literally erased. So okay. This is the kind of pushback that we face when we bring up these issues. And, you know, that's only one example. I've had numerous others. So it's very odd because I'm in a position where I appreciate that changes are being made and I appreciate being recognized for it. But it also is a feeling of kind of like a slap in the face, because I know that in the process of being an activist and calling for these changes, I haven't been treated well. It's mm-hmm. only now that people are getting positive feedback from the community that I'm being touted as someone to celebrate. But that hasn't always been the case.
Uh-huh. What else would you like, or is there anything else you would like to say about your experience in confronting these kind of well-established and racist practices and attitudes within clinical science and medical education?
Yeah, so one last thing I'd like to say is to just point out the labor that students have put into making these changes to make medicine more anti-racist and medical education. And it's really disappointing to see that students, especially Black students, Indigenous students, and other students of color, are having this labor put on them where it's not compensated, and they're often facing retaliation, when really it should be the job of the institutions to be pushing for these changes. So I just want to shout out the students that have been doing this work for years, and to also give credit to others like Dr. Amaka Inyanya and Dr. Vanessa Grubbs, who have spent decades on specifically the EGFR work that is only now starting to get recognition.
Naomi, it sounds like there are a lot of people who have contributed to this process of trying to get the racism out of medicine. And when we post the show on the website, I'll post some links to their work. This has been Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour, speaking today with Naomi Nkinsey, activist, medical student, and candidate for a master's degree in public health at the University of Washington. You can find Naomi and message her on her Twitter account, which is NNKINSI. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks to both of you, Patricia and Naomi. And now, Another World is Possible. In today's episode of Another World is Possible, we look at dystopias and the Cassandra problem. Let's start with a question. If you were writing now to warn others about underlying trends in the society that you thought will only get worse, what are the trends you would identify? The answers now might seem obvious. Climate change, for instance, or growing political authoritarianism. But what if you had been writing 25 or 35 years ago, like Octavia Butler or Fred Feil, and projected your warning in the form of dystopian novels set in the here and now, in the 2020s, as they did? What back then would you have warned against? And what if we had known back then, in the 1980s or 1990s, what we know now about what our society has become? What, in other words, if we had paid attention to their very smart warnings? Would we have acted any differently? Made other choices with our lives? Tried to reach out to others with a greater sense of urgency? Or would we, as the exploited and oppressed in this country and in the world, as workers and women and minority groups of so many types, still have been like the frogs in slowly heating water, adapting always to just a bit more discomfort as the temperature rises? I'm calling this the Cassandra problem. Cassandra was a priestess in the temple of the god Apollo back in the time of the Trojan War. Seeking her sexual favors, Apollo gave her the gift of prophecy. She could foretell the future. Unable to withdraw the gift when she rejected him. The gods apparently had rules against this sort of giving and taking back. Apollo added the vindictive restriction that no one would ever believe her predictions. As an example, when the Greeks pretended to leave Troy, but left behind the Trojan horse filled with Greek warriors, Cassandra was the one who saw through the trick and tried to warn her fellow Trojans. When they didn't believe her, she took action by herself, rushing the large wooden horse with an axe and with fire. But she was stopped by her disbelieving countrymen. We know how that turned out. The Trojans pulled the horse inside their gates, thinking it was a trophy, and celebrated what they thought was their victory. In the night, the Greek soldiers came out of the horse, opened the gates to their countrymen, and won the war. As for Cassandra, wise beyond humanity, but ever ignored, she went mad. 20th and 21st century Cassandras may or may not go mad, but they do write dystopian novels. Today, in Another World is Possible, we'll look primarily at one of these, set in our very year, Fred Feil's Goodman 2020. That was the theme song from The Guillotine by The Coup. Fred File was briefly an Oregonian. I knew him here in the early 1980s when he was working on this novel. Better known as a cultural critic, he focused on gender roles, especially expectations around masculinity, and some of those concerns are prominent in Goodman 2020. He and Octavia Butler, she writing a decade or so after he did, had similar visions of what society would be like by the time we got to 2020. But they wrote from the perspective of very different kinds of characters and with very different visions for where we, the recipients of their warning, might find hope. I'll return to Butler, especially her parable of the sower, in a future episode of Another World is Possible. So what did File, that's spelled P-F-E-I-L, what did Fred File identify as underlying the problems he foresaw? What was at the root of the more visible issues that would only become worse? Beneath issues like systemic racism and climate change, corporate control and political authoritarianism, all of which are strongly present in Goodman 2020, File identified the drive within our economic system to convert everything, and I do mean everything, into a source of profit for a small elite. I imagine him looking around, saying to himself, "What hasn't yet been turned into a commodity? What do we now hold in common, or think of as sacred and non-marketable, that could instead be privatized and made profitable? What could I highlight that now would seem inconceivable as an item for sale, but would get people to see how all facets of our lives are becoming thingified and turned into marketing opportunities?" Those were my words, of course, as I imagined the author's thinking process. What he chose was friendship. Ernest Goodman, the name sounds like someone out of those old religious novels like Pilgrim's Progress, where names are meant to tell you something about people's character. Ernest Goodman is a professional friend, graduate of a friendship training program, accredited and available for contractual hire as a friend. The book's epigraph, a quote from Walt Whitman, gives us a clue even before the story begins.
"Camarado, I give you my hand. I give you my love, more precious than money. I give you myself before preaching or law. Will you give me yourself? Will you come travel with me? Shall we stick by each other as long as we live?"
Love more precious than money. Whitman, of course, was a 19th century U.S. poet with a broader view of friendship than the sexual mores of his time acknowledged. Completely straightforward and heartfelt in Whitman, that quote as an epigraph in Goodman 2020 is nothing but irony. In the world of 2020, our very year, as File prophesied back in the 1970s and 1980s, corporations control and politicians do what they're told. Manufacturing has left the U.S. in search of cheaper, more readily controllable workers. Everyone not white and formerly working class whites are unemployed, no longer capitalist consumers, and driven to the peripheries of cities like the favelas and slums of third world countries. Middle class whites, with nothing to do but endlessly consume, are subsidized by the state, board, and sexually dysfunctional. Elites are no longer national, have no allegiance to any particular country, and form a small international ruling class dominated by corporate heads. The first few pages of Goodman 2020 set the context. The book begins,
"Foggy Bottom, the setting of this story's first scene, is an area of central Washington where political power is presumably held. In the White House, the Executive Office Building, FBI headquarters, etc. The Lincoln Memorial is within its environs, and at night, with the correct outdoor nocturnal pass, one can stand by the Potomac River, which bounds this area to the south and west, look across, and see the natural gas burning in John Kennedy's memorial, like some barbaric tribal campfire from another age."
You caught that, right? Power is only presumably held in the White House, etc. Then, after the action that sets the plot in motion, we're given an overview.
"A clumsy arrangement. Few people have jobs. Most work has been automated and or sent overseas. Yet multinationals still need many, if not most of us, as part of the huge market they must keep hold of to survive and expand. They cannot make enough by selling their products from one subsidiary to another, or from corporation to corporation, or by getting in on the little non-nuclear wars that flare up here and there from time to time. But in neighborhoods, it sometimes happens that a fine old brownstone caves in suddenly like a sick old person's face. Or the people in the upstairs apartment set fire to their own rooms and take off. People, good people, people who've always had enough, suddenly start shooting junk or taking other newer chemicals, like Hotzi, that bring immediate ecstasy at the cost of severe long-term damage. Someone finds a stain on a blouse bought in a Bloomingdale's, and the whole mall gets pulled apart. Guards come, people get torched down. Appropriate measures have been taken to keep the lid on this queasiness, these random outbursts. New security regulations, pass restrictions and curfews, more police, far better equipped. But it is a new, odd poverty and hard to control, this pointlessness, famine of purpose, drought of need."
The plot is complex and told from multiple points of view, woman and child, corporate head, and more. Briefly, Ernest Goodman undergoes real-life tests to determine his suitability as hired friend for the head of Omnicorp, gigantic multinational conglomerate. Goodman's weakness, or his vulnerability, is that his training and his job don't wholly define him. He's in a genuine love relationship with all its real difficulties and rewards, and helping to raise a child. In other words, he's also grounded in a reality that escapes people like Dick Devine, head of Omnicorp, who have everything and think they control everything. To control Ernest, they need to make him into one of them, to bring him entirely into their sanitized, controlled, pseudo-reality. Pushed too far, Ernest uses his training to rebel in what he thinks of as only an individual act of desperation and self-sacrifice, but finds unexpected solidarity. Along the way, there are nihilist groups created by corporations to engage in random acts of violence in order to provide outlets for mass frustration, and staged assassination attempts in which corporate subordinates actually are killed to provide brief thrills, momentary feelings of danger, of being alive, for jaded corporate heads. Omnicorp figures out new ways to profit from the devastation capitalism has caused, selling surveillance and security systems, and marketing heroin and other drugs through its clinics. Opening a new production facility in Latin America requires overthrowing the previous government there. We are taken inside the planning for a coup arranged with the compliance of other conglomerates and the connivance of the U.S. government. There's much more to say about Fred Feil's depiction of race, gender, environment, etc., and how he relates all these to each other and to commodification, the incessant drive that is capitalism, to turn everything into profit. Especially there's more to say about how, in this bleak forecast from decades ago, the author thought we might avoid his dystopia, and where he thinks we might find hope. We'll continue the discussion of Goodman 2020, Dystopia, and the Cassandra Problem in the next episode of Another World is Possible. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'd like to thank everyone on the show today, Old Moles Patricia Kohlberg and Bill Resnick, and their guests, Naomeen Kinsey and Emery Mort. And a special thanks to the resourceful staff at KBOO that keeps the station going when so many others around the country have had to close. We'll leave you today with a special anthem. This is Madeleine Peru's version of Leonard Cohen's anthem.
The birds, they sang at the break of day. Start again, I heard them say. Don't dwell on what has passed away or what is yet to be. Yeah, the wars, they'll be fought again. The holy dove, she'll be caught again. Bought and sold and bought again. The dove is never free. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.